And when a machine is indistinguishable to the observer, to the judge, from a human, then you might think, right? Then you've identified a machine that seems capable of thinking. It's remarkable. And then we can evaluate whether, in fact, the machine has some kind of special capacity for conversational intelligence or other forms of intelligence. But the reverse Turing test, without saying what being human is, you know, maybe something's dehumanizing. Maybe the environment we're in, the techno-social environment we're in, is dehumanizing if humans within that environment are indistinguishable with respect to some capability. It could be conversational intelligence, like in the Turing test, but it could be something else, like how we relate to each other or whether we have common sense. There's different capabilities. When a human being in a particular environment is indistinguishable from a simple, predictable, programmable machine, that would at least identify a situation in which the human seems remarkable and the context and the environment seems remarkable. And then we can evaluate whether, in fact, humans in that environment are affected by the techno-social environment, by the technologies that have configured the environment, to lose or have some diminished capacity in a way that matters.
That was Brett Frischman, professor in law, business, and economics at Villanova University. Brett is a renowned scholar in intellectual property and internet law, and he's also the author of Reengineering Humanity, which he co-authored with the philosopher Evan Selinger. The book explores the impact to society of big data, smart environments, and predictive analytics. In this fascinating episode, Brett is going to talk to us about reverse Turing tests, how we can better spot nudge creep, and also the potential impacts of prediction technologies in schools and universities. I hope you enjoy this episode with Professor Brett Frischman. So, Brett, thank you so much for joining me here on Digital Mindfulness. It's a real thrill to have you on the show, and I'm really glad and I'm really fascinated to be talking about your new book, Reengineering Humanity. So welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
So, Brett, I wonder if you'd introduce yourself to the audience, and I wonder if you'd talk to us a little bit about the book and why it's so important, but also maybe start with what was the avenue that led you to start thinking about and writing about the topics within Reengineering Humanity?
Sure. To introduce myself, I'm a professor of law at Villanova University. Really a university professor in law, economics, and business. I studied physics and math and undergraduate, and then went to engineering school and graduate school, and then went to law school, and have pretty much spent my academic career doing interdisciplinary work, always working at the intersection of law and other disciplines, economics, computer science, ethics, philosophy, and so on, and always trying to take a systematic and rigorous approach to doing that kind of interdisciplinary work. Sometimes that means spending the time to study with others, to sort of almost doing sort of mini PhDs in other disciplines so that I can get up to speed with a topic. And in many other circumstances, it means collaborating, finding good collaborators to work with. And so that's been my academic career as a scholar for the last 20 years or so. And that's, what I anticipate my future being for the next however long I'm lucky to keep doing it. The Reengineering Humanity book is a deep, systematic, rigorous look at the relationship between technology and humanity, or techno-social tools and humanity, really. So my co-author, Evan Selinger, is a philosopher of technology. The two of us look at both at technology and very broadly as the set of tools. So that includes institutions and laws and social norms, as well as sort of the more conventional things one might think of as technology, and try to look at how the tools that we shape and create, and which we've always done, you know, humans have done for millennia, how those tools affect who we are and who we can be as human beings, both individually and collectively, within and across, within a particular the current generation, but really across generations. The maybe the motivation for doing the book is there are many, really. I mean, the project of writing Reengineering Humanity was really sort of an 6 to 8 year long project at least. But it has its roots in earlier work. So many of the themes in Reengineering Humanity can be traced back to earlier work I did on infrastructure, the social and the social value of non-discriminatory access to and use of all kinds of infrastructure resources, all the things that we take for granted that are in the background, whether it's roads and the electricity grid or the ideas and basic research and knowledge systems that we all sort of and language that we all use and rely on often without sort of knowing where it comes from or who created it or how it became something that we're capable of accessing and using. The early work on infrastructure really was the first 10 years of my career, along with a related project about governing knowledge commons, or how communities create and share all kinds of intellectual resources, from data to patented inventions, to research, to creative expression. And that's still an ongoing project. And that's a series of books as well. The infrastructure book, the knowledge commons stuff, all sort of are background research and ideas and concepts that led me to be thinking about human systems and technology and the built or engineered environment and how it affects what we're capable of doing. At one point in maybe around 2010, 2011, I started thinking about an idea for something called reverse Turing tests. Basically, I had this concern that how would we know when a technology's dehumanizing in some way. So there's a lot of the, I read Nick Carr stuff and read a bunch of other work that was coming out sort of suggesting that technology was making people dumb or less capable of thinking for themselves. And a lot of the sort of public discourse would say, you'd have critics saying that this or that technology is dehumanizing. And I always didn't know what that meant. Like, what does it, I understand like slavery is dehumanizing. I understand that certain things are dehumanizing at like the extreme, but I couldn't quite wrap my head around what it meant to say, that your smartphone was dehumanizing or that, some of our everyday technologies we rely on are dehumanizing. And so someone asked me that at a conference or in a conference, we were sort of talking about it. And I said, one way you might think that it's, technology is dehumanizing is if it basically makes us or leads people to behave like machines. It gets us to be like, automatons. Like, that's one way you think about it. I'm not sure exactly how the idea came. I said, it's almost like you have a reverse Turing. If you had a reverse Turing test, you could identify when that's happening. And then we had a discussion about what that might mean. And that was one root of the idea that sort of started to grow over the next couple of years. And it became a major part of the Reengineering Humanity book how do we know when technology is leading us, is dehumanizing? Well, one way is if we become indistinguishable from a simple machine. If we start to behave robotically or mechanically, or another way to see it is when we start to perform someone else's script, someone else has sort of scripted what our behavior should look like, and we're just following that script. Well, that to me seemed to be a pretty good way to start thinking about when a technology's dehumanizing. And so that led to, I mean, I should stop rattling on about this, but there's a whole bunch of different ideas and things I was working on and thinking about that started me thinking about the question. And then this idea of a reverse Turing test made me think I might have something to say about sort of a method or an approach to identifying and evaluating how tools affect who we are as human beings. And that's when I started sort of mapping out the ideas that, you know, and that took a couple of years, mapping out the ideas for what would eventually become Reengineering Humanity. And I was fortunate at one point, I was telling all of this over the phone to Ryan Kahlo, a law professor at UW, University of Washington. And he said, well, you've got to meet Evan Selinger. And so I met Evan the day after Thanksgiving. We met that Friday after Thanksgiving, that evening, for a beer on the Erie Canal Trail. There's a little place, and we sat out there with a beer and started talking about our research interests and our ideas, and this idea of, like, could we do, you know, some kind of reverse Turing test? Like, does this make sense? You know, what leads us to behave in a machine-like way with regard to thinking capacities? And Evan was like, well, I've been thinking a lot about outsourcing certain kinds of thinking tasks to computers or to others vis-a-vis computers. We hit it off. I think by the end of the night, we agreed, let's go author the book together. And then then it was like a multi-year project.
There's a great drive at the moment in IT discussions towards automation. And this permeates across the whole IT stack, you know, whether you're talking about marketing or whether you're talking about commerce or infrastructure, the discussions largely are the same. And some have argued quite persuasively that the entire history of the Industrial Revolution and technological development is towards greater automation. But in your last answer, you linked humanization very strongly with agency. And when we are dehumanized by our technology, that results in a loss of agency. So what I'd love you to do is to just elaborate on that a little bit more. And in particular, why is it that concept of agency that really links so strongly with humanity and being a human being?
Yeah, it's tough, because if you say this or that technology is dehumanizing, the first question is, then what do you know? To say that, you've got to have a sense of what it means to be human. Like, what, you know, how is something dehumanizing or actually, you know, or humanizing? Like, what's your base? You have to have some baseline conception of what being human is, to be able to evaluate whether a technology is somehow diminishing or detracting or enhancing whatever it is that you're talking about from that baseline. And so we spent multiple years trying to sort of think this through. And to be honest, the reverse Turing test approach helped to some degree, because if you think about, what Turing, so the Turing test itself was, you know, Turing asks, can machines think? He recognizes right away that is this definitional, intractable kind of question. And he says, well, you know, rather than try to answer that by like arguing forever about the definitions, let's instead shift to an observational test. And we can evaluate whether a machine is capable of thinking by using humans as a baseline. Right. So if the machine, and I won't go through the whole Turing testing, I'm happy to, but that's not really your question, and we can get there later if you want, but or it's in the book. But it's this idea of, you know, you've got an observer asking, it's conversational tech, so it's conversational human intelligence. And when a machine is indistinguishable to the observer, to the judge, from a human with regard to that capability, then you might think, right? Then you've identified a machine that seems capable of thinking. It's remarkable. And then we can evaluate whether, in fact, the machine has some kind of special capacity for conversational intelligence or other forms of intelligence, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. But the reverse Turing test, if we think about, well, I don't, without saying what being human is, like that, I don't want to get caught up in that definitional thing to start. I want to say, well, you know, maybe something's dehumanizing. Maybe the environment we're in, the techno-social environment we're in, is dehumanizing if humans within that environment are indistinguishable with respect to some capability. It could be conversational intelligence, like in the Turing test, but it could be something else, like how we relate to each other or whether we have common sense. There's different capabilities we might test. But when a human being in a particular environment is indistinguishable from a simple, predictable, programmable machine, that would at least identify a situation in which the human seems remarkable and the context and the environment seems remarkable. And then we can evaluate whether, in fact, humans in that environment are affected by the techno-social environment, by the technologies that have configured the environment, to lose or have some diminished capacity in a way that matters. And so then you've got to figure out, well, what are the basic capabilities that humans have that machines don't, or a simple machine, a predictable programmable machine doesn't, deterministic machine doesn't, that matter. And so Evan and I spent quite a bit of time, and this is developed at length in the book, is this idea that, well, you know, what it is to be human, like what being human is, or, you know, you might think of from evolutionary biological sort of science as sort of a, you know, let's look at Homo sapiens and what distinguishes Homo sapiens from other species. And that can kind of give us a sense of, you know, what it means to be human descriptively, right? And then you could say, well, there's a bunch of ways to go about doing that. But you might say some of the things that humans can do that distinguish us as a species from other species is our capacity to imagine things that don't exist, to communicate about those things that don't exist, and then to collectively engineer a built environment or engineer the world, and in doing so, re-engineer ourselves, right? So the fact that human beings can imagine laws, conceptions of justice, you know, future technologies, right? Things that don't exist, then they can talk about them, communicate about them, pass them on across generations so that they're durable, so that they're lasting, so they can reflect value commitments. That's a pretty powerful thing that humans can do. And then I think what the second step, so what it means to be human, you might think of in the terms I just described, but you might think what matters about being human, like what's normatively important, what the value prop, you know, what's valuable about being human, what matters about being human, is how we exercise that capability to re-engineer, build the environment in a way that affects our own capabilities, affects who we are and are capable of being. So like things like free will, things that like, you know, our ability to relate to each other are in part, in certain ways, are contingent on the built world, on the world we've built, but not just that we in the present generation, that past generations have sacrificed a lot to build a world that we have today, and we're building the world for the future. And we're exercising that, those basic capabilities of imagining and collectively creating and sustaining commitments in the infrastructures and the institutions that we build. Like that is, so the way we would conceptualize humanity is what it means to be human is one thing. What matters about being human are those value commitments about who we are and we're capable of being that are sort of built into the environment and thus ourselves over time. And then to go, you know, and so because we do the reverse Turing test sort of approach, which is one of many approaches, you can use other approaches, but just the approach we sort of develop in the book, that approach helps us to focus on human capabilities that are essential to human flourishing or that are relative to human flourishing. So our commonsensical thinking, our ability to relate to each other, our exercise of free will, and autonomy and agency, like those are things, those are capabilities that past and the present generation have committed to through the institutions and the world that we've built and engineered for ourselves and for future generations, and that are contingent, right? They can be lost. They can go away. It's not inevitable that human beings will be able to exercise free will or common sense or to relate to each other socially in a way that, you know, you and I can read each other's cues, even though we can't, because right now we can't see each other on the screen. If we were in person, we would be able to. But that's not inevitable, right? Those capabilities can be lost. And the question is, how can they be lost? Well, they can be lost based on how we build the technologies and tools and the environment that we build. And so there's the idea about dehumanization or humanization is about how the tools and the world we build, the environments we build and reconfigure, enhance, enable, or disable, reduce, detract from those basic capabilities. And so that's what we, throughout the book, well, we explain that and we try to sort of develop a way of thinking about and identifying what some of those capabilities are and how to sort of see when they're at risk through the technologies that we use. Sort of when we outsource, to use Evan used that word a lot. So when you outsource certain capabilities or tasks to supposedly smart technical systems, you put at risk your own the capability that you're outsourcing. Not always. It depends on whether there are other opportunities to practice it or whether it will atrophy over time. And those are the kinds of things that we need longitudinal, you know, empirical work to study. That's the kind of work that we, at the end of the book, we sort of suggest that some of the kind of empirical work that needs to be done that isn't currently being done because it's not fashionable necessarily to do.
Brett, in the book, you make a strong mention about the impacts of Fitbits and other wearables. And it'd be really great if you can talk about different examples where the automation or where behavior direction from technology actually leads us into behaviors or to goal states that are actually desirous for us, and also the other way, when actually the behaviors that we're being directed towards don't impact positively upon us.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, so we talk a bit about Fitbits or activity tracking in the very first chapter of the book. The positive feature of Fitbits is it can enable people to manage their own lives. It can provide you with an awareness of how active you are so that you can make plans about how active you want to be, right? So it can also allow you to set goals and recognize whether you achieve those goals. It can also allow people, it can enable people to work in groups. So if you are a runner you'd call it football, and here in the US we call it soccer, so I'm a soccer/football player. When I'm in training, right, a Fitbit can be useful when I'm doing interval training or to help me know certain data about heart rate and how many steps I've taken and different things. Right? So like the fitness tracking technology, it's used in sports, for example, quite a bit, can be very useful when it enables people to know more about themselves and to plan their own activities. It's just a simple, to give the simple example of why it could be positive. On the negative side, the reason we end up expressing some concern about Fitbits, we use it as an example, really. It's just a good example to highlight some of the issues and concepts that we then develop for a lot of other examples in the book. So I talk a bit about when my middle son came home during first or second grade. It was first grade, I think. Came home in first grade and was all excited because the school had told him, his physical education teacher had told him, like, hey, you know, Jake, you've been selected. You're one of a few kids who gets to get a free activity watch, which is basically sort of a generic version of a Fitbit. And you're going to get to participate in this program and it's wonderful and blah, blah, blah. And so he came home after school, like super excited, like I'm getting this, you know, this new Fitbit and that school's going to give it to me and it's going to be really cool. And then I said, okay, well, when do you get this? When does it happen? And he didn't know. And then I got a message from the school a couple of days later that doesn't really say anything about, it's an email message. It doesn't really say anything about informed consent, or it doesn't say about who's getting what information or what's going to be collected or any of that stuff. It's just very, like, you know, very, very, it's a pitch, basically. It's just sort of selling the idea, like, hey, this is wonderful. Your kid gets to participate in this new program. And they're like, you know, don't worry about taking it off at night, or, you know, just let them keep it on for 2 weeks straight. It'll collect the data. And then, you know, if you want to talk to your teacher, they can, like, they'll talk, the phys ed teacher, they'll talk to you about fitness planning and stuff. And I just, everyone in the community, by the way, who got selected for this, other kids who did and their parents were just excited. Everybody went along with it. I went ballistic. Like, I just couldn't believe it. And in part because the way that the note that, you know, that the way that the note had been written that the parents got, it just sort of suggested a 24/7 bodily child surveillance was just a given, right? Just that, you know, bedtime and bath time surveillance was just something that no one really thought about. And no one did think about it until I went to the general counsel's office for the school district. And I mentioned, like, you know, this child surveillance program you guys have setting up, have you really thought about the price? And he just stopped before I could finish saying what I was going to say. I was like, what? Child surveillance? 24 bedtime? And I was like, yeah, you didn't think about the bedtime surveillance? Like, you told your kids are going to wear this for 2 weeks straight. It's collecting data that you're collecting. And his eyes just, he was like, what? No, we hadn't really thought of it. That didn't even occur to the school district that that's what they were doing. So most people hear this story and they immediately think this is all about privacy, right? It's just privacy law and, you know, getting the privacy issues correct. And I think that's the wrong point, right? It's not only about who collects what data and how long are they going to hold it and who's going to have access to it and is it going to go to third parties or not and all that stuff. And all that stuff's really important. But even if you fix those things, like even if you do informed consent right, like, and even if you kept the information collected just by the phys ed teacher, let's say, no one else gets access to it. But the thing that privacy, if you could fix the privacy problems, and that I think you should if you're going to do this program, but there's still the question of that no one really thinks about, which is that you're basically conditioning a generation of school kids to accept without question bodily surveillance by the school. Like, they trust the school, the parents, everybody trusts the school. So you're sort of conditioning them to accept a certain kind of interaction, a certain kind of surveillance technology. In other words, you're shaping their beliefs and preferences about privacy. So even if you solve the privacy problem, they sort of tell the parents, don't worry, we're not going to, you're still slapping devices on kids and collecting the information. And they see that as okay. They learn to accept it. And then there's some other things that we talk about. I don't know how long to go on about this, but so the other thing we say a bit about when evaluating the deployment of a device like this, if the point is to combat obesity and combat, like, encourage people to be fit in schools, there are other tools, right? It's one thing if I'm a hardcore runner and I know exactly, I'm already planning my runs and I'm thinking about what I'm doing, and a Fitbit type device allows me to have much more accurate information so I can do better planning. It's a different thing to introduce Fitbits in schools to train the kids to just, you know, shape their beliefs and preferences about the technology. But at the same time, the reason you're doing it is to sort of encourage them to sort of gamify their activity levels, right? Like it's a game. Like you, here's the number of steps you took. You could take some more. That'll sort of nudge them along the way to be more fit. And we're going to collect sort of near perfect information about how active you are, not by asking you or having, you know, so the alternative way that like schools sometimes, or at least historically, could collect this information is they have kids fill out forms, or they have them have like a journal where they keep track of like their activity levels and things. Mm. But, you know, those journals are inaccurate. They're not perfect. But the difference is at least the kids thinking about how active they are. Like they're engaging with the data and they're reporting it. They're thinking about what I want to report to my gym teacher and what I want other people in the class to know about my activity level. When you do it through the Fitbit, you're outsourcing sort of perfect data collection only because the kid's no longer involved in the data collection. And they're sort of like, you're taking a human out of the loop, and that's efficient and accurate. But it also means that the human who's still performing the activity, right, has no say. They don't deliberate. They don't think about who's getting the information or what information or any of those things. So like I would say, like if you're going to do Fitbits in schools, not that I would necessarily advocate that you should, I think there's other ways to do it. But if you're going to, right, have the kids be the only people who get access to the data, or at least initially, and then have them report to the school teacher with the aid of having, you know, I wore this Fitbit for the day. This is how active I was. And then I get to decide what to report. Right? I engage directly with the data. It tells me about how active I am. And then I can sort of report it on a paper form or in some other way to the teacher. Hmm. Right. So then you're getting you're engaging the student with their own activity, with the data, as opposed to sort of circumventing them. And just sort of providing the information to the school teacher or other third parties to sort of develop a fitness plan. And the real idea is just to nudge them. Anyway, so that I could go on and on about this, but those are the kind of, the downsides are, is that you train people. I mean, you train people, you shape their beliefs and preferences, that you outsource the thinking to this device, the data collection to this device, and it's perfect, but you take the human out of the loop. And I guess the other downside is that I should highlight, because this is why we use the example in the book, is that we use it to set up the idea of creep, of function creep, which computer scientists will all know, or surveillance creep, which surveillance scholars know. But the idea, and I'm writing a paper right now about nudge creep, but the idea of creep is just you develop a tool for one purpose. You justify it for purpose number one. And then the tool, once used and deployed for purpose number one, it's that much, you find purpose number two through 10, and then 10 through 20, right? And so it doesn't need to be that much. It can be one to two to three. But the point is each step, each time you use it for one purpose, it's that much easier to deploy it for another purpose. And a lot of times this is good. I mean, this is general purpose technologies and economics, like an infrastructure stuff. Like there's a lot of reasons why finding new uses of a given technology can often be quite beneficial for society. But in the context of social engineering, like engineering people, I'm a little bit more concerned about things like introducing Fitbits in schools, training students and parents, like, you know, conditioning them, shaping their beliefs about the technology. And then, you know, it's that much easier just to add another sensor. It's not just how active you are physically. Let's do mental attentiveness. Like, how attentive are you in class? Well, we can monitor that information too. And it's that much easier to convince everyone, hey, we can do that too, when you've already done the physical fitness, you know, tracking and sort of, you know, people have gotten used to it and accepted it. And then you say, well, we'll just add, it's very cheap. We just add another sensor and that'll enable us, they'll empower us to do the next bit of tracking and then social engineering. And then it's, well, you know, moods, you know, if we could just detect everyone's mood, we know who's happy and who's not happy in the classroom and in the hallways and on the bus and on the way home. And hey, if it's 24/7, we'll know how happy they are at home too. And I know it sounds like speculative sci-fi stuff, but you know what? In the book, we talk about these examples as if they are speculative. We sort of use them as thought, what philosophers call thought experiments. Mm-hmm. And within a year of publishing the book, some of the things we thought of as thought experiments that were speculative, but trying to illustrate the path, they're already being developed. They're out there.
Like what? What are some of the things that have come to pass?
Well, the mood prediction technology in schools, for example. Okay. Like there are vendors, you know, selling it. There are school boards, you know, schools, you know, getting on board. It's just the camel's gotten his nose under the tent or something like once the frog boiling in water, like once you've brought the temperature up subtly one step at a time, it's that much easier to keep going as people get comfortable with it. But yeah, the mood prediction, there's so many things going on. I mean, ed tech, I think, is like the big fighting ground for a lot of this stuff because, school districts are so pressed for funding, and teachers work so hard to help their students, and they're under such pressure to meet metrics and perform, get their students to perform a certain way, that the promises of supposedly smart ed tech technology that can sort of, you know, personalize education and like detect, you know, for each student, detect their mood, their attentiveness, their successes and failures, and then personalize the stimuli necessary to get them to get the uniform response that we all need to succeed. There's just so much pressure, and the technology vendors are quite persuasive. So it's just, you know, that, I mean, I think in the school, there's mood predict. There's a recent ProPublica analysis of aggression detection technologies where they have microphones in the hallways and they've got a machine learning algorithm that detects based on the pattern and the volume and whatnot of the voices in the hallway, like when, you know, you can make predictions of violence. It's just a simple microphone with a machine learning, you know, with a sensor system. Like the deployment of this stuff in schools is one of the interesting areas where you just see it kind of creeping and creeping. You know, surveillance technology just creeps. So the Fitbits are just a good Fitbits and activity watches are just a good first step to seeing how that process works.
It is interesting you say that because. I guess some advocates for this might say, well, if it helps us to, if this kind of technology helps us to detect maybe emotionally at-risk kids, then it allows caregivers, educators, to intervene much more quickly, if at all, right, for these kids that they might not necessarily have been able to detect before.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the pitch, and to some degree, there's a bit of truth to it. This is where it pushes you into comparison of different tools for, you know, sort of detecting and helping truly at-risk students. I remember being at Princeton, I think it was a year, maybe a year and a half ago, for a meeting, an ethics and AI sort of meeting. And it had to do with there was an ed tech example, and there was a school teacher in the room, or a couple of school teachers, a number of schools. This is what's neat about some of the things that they do at Princeton in this regard, is they invite, it's open to the public, and they actually get people from the public in to these small room discussions. And there were a couple of teachers, but one of this one woman who was a, you know, 40 year school, public school teacher, responded to an argument like the one you just made. And she said, look, you know, you don't need to invest in like surveillance technologies throughout the school to detect the minority of students who are at risk for a variety of them, whether it's emotional or other sort of at risk students. You need to invest in teachers. And teachers, she's like, you know, in my classroom, I've been teaching 40 years. Like, I could tell you quite easily who the students, and we know who the students who are at risk are. We don't necessarily have the resources to help them. We try, and the school district try, you know, at times try. But it's not that there aren't signs, and there aren't, that the school doesn't have the means for detecting, you know, I mean, there may be people who slip through and they don't detect, but her, I remember her point being like this idea that you need to deploy, you know, surveillance, you know, really, you know, you know, complete surveillance systems within the school with like amped up sensors that are evaluating each person because of their emotion or because of their likelihood of, you know, having issues of that are not necessarily emotional ones either, is way overblown. And her point was that, you know, we have those tools. Teachers now actually are skilled. They are trained. They could always use more training in certain things, but it's you know, humans do a pretty good job with a lot of those things. So anyway, I think it's an interesting debate. I just remember her, she stuck out in my mind because the way you just described it was exactly what one of the other attendees had sort of, that was sort of their counter as well. But you know, it's like the claims that you need facial recognition in schools to stop terrorist threats in schools, or you need to stop like the gun violence in American schools by having, you know, facial recognition throughout the schools. And it's, again, I think that's not proven that facial recognition is the best of the available sets of solutions to that problem.
So, Brent, in your day-to-day role as a law scholar, I'm interested to know what role you think exists for policymakers and for lawmakers in this particular space that we're talking about, in particular with regards to the construction and deployment of humanizing technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's multiple levels at which lawmakers and policymakers play a role. I mean, in some ways it's there's not just one, I guess. I mean, there are the problems about technology hype and the outsourcing all kinds of thinking and relating and other tasks to supposedly smart systems is a systemic problem. And so I think, I mean, you know, lawmakers and policymakers, it just depends at what level we're talking. So if we're talking about schools, absolutely, right? I mean, so there's plenty of things that, you know, the regulators or funders, you know, public funding of schools, you know, for technology, there's plenty of sort of things they should be thinking about before they, you know, jump on the ed tech bandwagon. If it's instead we talk about smart cities, right? And so every city in the country, every city in the world, right? And I don't know, I'm exaggerating, not every city, but you know, cities around the world are being pitched and are considering seriously different versions of, you know, the smart city blueprint. Like, how do we become a smart city? You know, should our public infrastructures be smart? Our roads, our electricity grid, our schools, our hospitals, and what does it mean to make them smart, right? There's a host of policy and legal issues involved with going down that path. We can go into that, or there's things like, you know, there's a big emphasis right now on what to do about the big tech companies. It can, you know, and there's a bunch. There's things like content moderation, and then there's things like breaking up big tech, and then there's antitrust interventions, and there's things like privacy law, all of which are sort of institutional, sort of legal institutional interventions that are of concern for law and policymakers in most jurisdictions, and all of which sort of the idea of the how technology shaping human capabilities is relevant to all of those questions. So it's kind of a, I think our book is a book that pretty much I think all policy, you know, that policymakers and lawmakers should be reading and thinking about engaging with some of the arguments. What it does is help lay out reasons for and justifications for thinking through a bunch of the ethical issues that are being debated in a more rigorous way. I think Evan and I describe we describe a lot of the issues involving the reengineering of humanity as we call it humanity's techno-social dilemma, and we frame it as a macro level, like sort of a wicked problem or a tragedy of the commons that's comparable in many ways to climate change. And I say that in the sense that, if you think about climate change, there's no silver bullet solution. First of all, in diagnosing the problem, there's not just one cause. You can't just say it's big oil or big coal, right? I mean, it is in part attributable to big oil and big coal, but it's also attributable to the entire economic and political system across generations that's heavily dependent upon fossil fuel consumption. Mm-hmm. And those systems have multiple components. Some have to do with food production and food waste, and some have to do with energy production and transportation, and it's just super complicated, both in terms of diet, and some of the causes are big companies, but some of the causes are individuals. All of us daily contribute to climate change. And when you come try to figure out solutions that lawmakers and policymakers should be sort of contemplating to deal with climate change, you similarly have to think of it as a multi-leveled problem, a system problem, complex systems problem, where, a carbon tax is important, but it's necessary but insufficient. And there's a variety of other things, whether it's managing the food production system and sort of minimizing food waste. My brother Chad Fishman works at Project Drawdown, and they're sort of identifying 100 different things we currently could do with existing technology to deal with climate change. And you kind of have to do all of them. So lawmakers have to be attendant to a whole bunch of different things that they want to deal with climate change. Some are at the macro level, at the really big global scale, and some of them are at the very micro level, sort of the kinds of things that people in their homes and in their local communities have to deal with. And that's a long-winded way to say it. I think the same exact thing is true when it comes to humanity's techno-social dilemma. The dilemma of building increasingly relying on supposedly smart techno-social systems to micromanage all of our lives through algorithmic data-driven systems. I mean, that's what makes them supposedly smart. Mm-hmm. And as we deploy these systems in our homes, in our workplaces, on our streets, in our schools, throughout government, and throughout pretty much every social system that you can think of, there is a push to make it smart through these collection of technologies. And I understanding the problem as a multi-level system problem helps you to see that on the solution side, how to deal with it, how to diagnose it, and then how to deal with it is also multi-level. So policymakers and lawmakers can think at the very macro level about the national and international systems, how we approach technical systems. And there's some things at that level, like questioning what is almost sort of a given, which is the benefit of sort of open interoperability seamless transactions, some of these sort of big concepts that we endorse at the macro level need to be, we need to stop and think about them. And then there's, you know, then it goes all the way down to things like smart cities, but it also goes down to like the family and the home, where I don't really think lawmakers and policymakers need necessarily to intervene. I don't think they should be intervening in sort of like how parents make decisions about technology in the home. Some of those things are just interventions at the very micro level that are necessary and important, but aren't really the province of policymakers and lawmakers. And so there's I guess the long-winded answer to your question, it boils down to like lawmakers and policymakers have a lot to do at the macro, the meso, and the micro levels of the systems that sort of we are all embedded in.
So Brett, one of the things that you have mentioned is that the book is necessarily multidisciplinary, that it drew upon a lot of different influences to eventually come into being. So can you tell us what different skills and different industries that were drawn upon to bring out this book?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a lawyer, law professor who is often dealing in economics and writing in economics journals and sort of thinking in economic terms. So those two disciplines are really just base level background stuff for me. So I'm always thinking in those terms. I think there's plenty of economics and there's plenty of sort of legal and institutional thinking in the book. What was new and really, you know, my co-author Evan added helped with a lot of this, like thinking through this. There's philosophy was actually an area where I hadn't spent a whole lot of time prior to this book, but I found myself drawn in a lot. So we've got a whole chapter about something called the extended mind, which is a theory in philosophy about how. It's about how technology and our minds and our relate to each other, and it's largely a theory that, and it connects with cognitive science, psychology, cognitive science, and philosophy. Sort of intersect in this sort of theory of the mind, the philosophy of mind. And so for that, you know, that was one area where we wrote a chapter and had a lot to say about the implications of. You know, that theory is large about how you use technology. You are extending your mind kind of extended beyond your brain and into the technologies. And so we engage with that theory, but we also suggest that as you are reaching out with your mind through the technologies, you're also inviting others in. And that is something that the people who engage in that discourse often ignore at their peril. Right. So as I'm using a smartphone to extend my mind so that I can think through my smartphone to use Google Maps or to use Google to search and find more information, I'm also inviting Google or Waze or whomever into my mind. And that sort of is an area where it's philosophy as well as cognitive science that are sort of important to our development of those ideas. And we, you know, similarly in our free will chapter. We have a whole chapter on free will and engineered determinism, where we dig deeply into free will and basically add to the discourse in that field, at the same time making a set of arguments that we think everyone on this planet would care about, which is that you know, what's most at risk in this dilemma that we describe is your ability to exercise your free will, is your capacity to think for yourself and determine upon reflection your own will, your own preferences, beliefs, values, and intentions in life. And that like the threat is of one of engineered determinism, where your life is determined not by nature or fate or some inevitable sense of what has happened in the past determines what your future. No, it's that what the real risk to your free will is that the world being built by others increasingly determines what's possible for you, so that you become a script follower. You perform your life rather than author it. And so that whole discussion, again, sort of took us into the deeply into philosophy, you know, some connection to the cognitive science as well. So we do quite a bit with behavioral, cognitive science, behavioral law and economics, behavioral psychology, nudging. Those are areas that we draw heavily on. And then I'd say, you know, obviously we have the big section, a whole part of the book that deals with these reverse Turing tests that required us to dig deeply into the AI, the literature about artificial intelligence, and again, cognitive science, and then connecting that to philosophy. So I guess it's philosophy, economics, cognitive science, and within some of the fields of economics, I mean, we deal with, you know, micro and stuff, but also development economics in the sense that we sort of draw on Amartya Sen's capabilities approach as sort of a way to think about the capabilities that are essential for human flourishing. And so there's a bunch of different disciplines all coming together in a ways that I think are accessible throughout the book. And we use tons of examples and thought experiments to sort of engage the reader and sort of, you know, I taught the book in a seminar last semester at the law school. And with the exception of one chapter on engineering humans with contracts, which has a bunch of law in it, the students who are all, you know, graduate students in law, they all loved it. They all liked it, but they were like that, you know, the coolest thing about the course is that it's like I'm you know, catching up and learning on all these different disciplines in ways that I didn't really knew that they intersected, which is probably like my happiest moment was at the end of this, you know, I read the course evaluations and they're all sort of like, you know, chiming in on how cool it was. And I'm like, yes, it worked. Like, you know, which I think is that the book is a good read on your own. I also think it's a cool book to read and talk with others about, like in small groups. I think that's where really I did that with my students. And I was learning from them a ton, just hearing what the reactions were to different parts of the book. It was really kind of, that was a really fun way to do it.
Of all of the other podcast guests that we've had on the show, some of the most fascinating discussions we've had are related to free will. And in particular, when these different apps and services can almost substitute our natural proclivity towards negative actions, or when we, you know, can nudge us towards our goals. For example, in financial services or with health and nutrition. So I'm wondering what you think about that, when the nudges and the different and the lack of free will that we have sometimes in a digital space can nudge us towards being better.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm often accused of sort of Goldilocksing it, which is like, you know, it's, you know, yeah, you know, this, or it's just a conventional sort of lawyer's answer was like, it depends, or yeah, it's good and it's bad. Like, it depends. I mean, but it's true. I mean, I use technology. Evan and I are by no means anti-technology in the slightest. I mean, pro-tech. I mean, as you go back to the infrastructure book, and I'm sort of waxing very positively and utopian almost about the internet and digital network technologies that are built on top of it. And in, for many ways, I still believe a lot of, you know, a lot of that. There are huge benefits. There are definitely ways in which, and same thing with nudging. Like, I'm writing a paper right now on nudging humans, and it's critical of nudging and yet friendly to nudging, because sometimes some nudges are absolutely beneficial for society and the people being nudged. It's just that not all of them are. And the underlying logic of nudging is easily warped and used in ways that provide the illusion of choice and the illusion of, you know, provide superficial benefits for the person being nudged, all the while benefiting third parties or others. Like, when the choice architect who's architecting your choices and using behavioral data to sort of figure out how to help you overcome your biases is actually benefiting you slightly, but benefiting themselves or other third parties more, then it's an imperfect, at best, it's an imperfect nudge, but it's a nudge that very well might be, you might be skeptical about. That doesn't mean that all nudges are bad. There are a lot of nudges that make great sense and that really are helpful to people. And the same thing is true of modern digital network technology. I tend to be quite critical of highly personalized, supposedly smart tech. But again, sometimes personalized tech can be quite good. It can help people satisfy their already existing preferences in a way that helps you find the things you want. That is, of course, assuming what is you want is stable and already pre-existing, and you know what you want, and that the system that's personalized isn't shaping what your demands are in a way that is producing a response. So it's personalized stimulus to generate a response that is not necessarily a response that attends to your pre-existing stable preferences, but actually is, more in the interest of someone else. I think that's why a rigorous, I think that's the advantage of our approach, is that because we try to be rigorous and nuanced about it, we're trying to show where technology and technosocial engineering, which is a big concept in the book, is unavoidable, right? Even this podcast discussion, I'm trying to persuade you to, you and I are engaged in a conversation. We're sort of shaping, we're trying to shape each other's beliefs and maybe those of the audience, right? The idea that is not, and technology is enabling us to have this conversation in a way that will reach an audience that we otherwise would reach. Like, all of those things in general are beneficial, especially in the abstract. It's when things cross a line, and the question that we engage with in the book is, when does that line cross? How do we know when a line is crossed? And again, we go to the reverse strength as a way to think about this. Well, a line is crossed when we start to behave in a mechanical, robotic, machine-like way, where we're not thinking for ourselves, or we're not acting on behalf of ourselves, but we're performing someone else's script. And those are the hard things. And then empirically testing that is one of the, you mentioned policymakers, lawmakers, what they'd be doing. The other thing I didn't mention, but I probably should have, and in responding to that earlier question, has to do with funding basic research into to study and better understand the relationship between technology and humanity, how we shape ourselves through the tools we develop and use. And that means longitudinal studies about how humans' capabilities are affected by the tools they use. And that's hard to do that. I'll give you another real quick example. We ran my co-author and I in a different project. It's Catherine Henshin. We ran a little experiment on Facebook, dealing with fake happy birthday notifications. And it's interesting when you think about happy birthday notifications on Facebook. How do we evaluate that stimulus on Facebook? You might say, so many people are like, that's great. Then I get to, I wouldn't otherwise know your birthday. I wish you happy birthday. And some people like getting a lot of messages on their birthday on Facebook. It makes them feel good. And all that, I'm not contesting that. But what Catherine and I did is we had Confederates basically change their birthday to a fake birthday. And we look at the fake, what are the response rates? Do people stop and think about the veracity of the signal? In other words, the fake birthday signal. And do they stop and think about what to say in response, or do they behave automatically? So they're basically using system one rather than system two. They're just responding They're responding without thinking about the signal, and they're responding with a scripted response. This may seem abstract, but like if I told you it was my birthday today, or you'd probably say happy birthday. If I saw you in the coffee shop and I tell the barista it's my birthday today, they say it's happy birthday. And if I tell you online, you get a notification from Facebook that it's my birthday today, and you respond happy birthday. Well, what's the difference? Whether it's on Facebook or it's in the coffee shop, you know. The thing is, we're what's called weak ties. Like, there's no reason, you don't really know my birthday. The barista at the coffee shop doesn't know my birthday. They have no reason to stop and think about it, so they respond with a social script. Whether that script's offline or online doesn't really matter. But here's the thing, and this is based on an anecdote, by the way. This is another reason I started writing the book, by the way. This is one of the early things that got me going. Because I actually did this. I changed my birthday on Facebook because I was annoyed by all these notifications I got. And then 6 months later, I got a ton of responses, the same number. It didn't really change. Everybody kept responding. But what caught my attention was a response from two close relatives who know my birthday, who we celebrated my birthday together. They responded, "Oh, happy birthday, Brett." That's what caught my attention. Wait a minute. Why? They know my birthday. How did my sister, how did she respond to happy birthday? And the thing is, because she didn't stop and think about it. She just responded to the stimulus automatically. And her response was happy birthday, Brett. Like the convent, you know, very scripted response that she uses for all, people just use routinely. But that routine automatic response is what caught my attention. That's the signal to me, at least. It's not perfect. So Catherine and I are running an experiment to test this, and we need more tests like this on other platforms and in other contexts. But that's the troubling thing, right? That in that sense, Facebook is arguably programming an automatic machine-like response in a situation where the counterfactual, where someone would behave differently if they weren't on Facebook. If I told my mother in the coffee shop, for example, "Hey, Mom, it's my birthday," 6 months away from my actual birthday, she'd say, "What the heck are you talking about? I know when, I carried you for 9 months. I know when your actual birthday. What are you talking about? It's not your birthday today." But when that same person responds to a Facebook notification, "Oh, happy birthday," on your fake birthday, that to me is an indication of something. Funny thing is, Facebook is about, I mean, one thing people celebrate about Facebook is it increases your social network, right? There's all these people who are your friends. What it does is it expands your social, your ties. You've got many more weak ties, right? But there's only, each of us can only manage the time and attention and emotional and social capital. We can only manage so many relationships. And so the question is, one of the questions is, when we manage many, many, many more weak ties in our lives, whether it's on Facebook or on Twitter or on LinkedIn or whatever, whatever Instagram or whatever other platform you want to focus on, when we start managing many, many, many more weak ties, at what cost to our strong ties? Right? Do we just start become routine, automatic managers of weak social relationships, right? And pay less attention to our strong ties? This is just a question. I don't have the answer. These are the kinds of things that we might care about. And the judgment, the evaluation of, do you want a world in which you've got, an incredibly large number of weak ties and, you're strong in very smaller number of strong ties, or the number of strong ties you have, the relationship is not as strong as it would otherwise be, right? That's a value question that I think we can engage with. I don't think there's there's necessarily a right answer, or that Frischman's answer is necessarily Selinger's answer, someone else's answer. But it seems like we should at least be aware of the trade-off, or the way in which the different technologies we interact with in the world that we're building affects our relationships.
Brett, where is the best place for people to come and find out more about your work and connect with you?
So I've got the Villanova website, the faculty website. Evan and I have a book website, so you can just reengineeringhumanity.com. It has links to stuff. I write I've written a bunch of Scientific American pieces. So if you go to Scientific American and you search for that, me, you'll find some stuff. Actually, the paperback's coming out in September, so folks can always grab it there.
That's great. Well, Brett, thanks so much for spending some time with us today here on Digital Mindfulness, and congratulations on the paperback. It was a pleasure having you on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. A lot of fun. Anytime.